1987, the year in review. I'm Ken Herrera on the UPI Radio Network.
The guided missile frigate USS Stark was hit by an air-launched Exocet missile.
I come to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ.
I got a crash on the airport. Airport's closed.
Okay, airport's closed. We got a crash at the airport.
I intend to be a candidate for the presidency of the United States in 1988.
This campaign cannot go on.
Let's let the people decide. I'm back in the race.
Senator, I believe the president has the authority to do what he wants with his own staff.
I today announce my intention to nominate Robert Bork to be an associate justice.
I intend to nominate and ask the Senate to confirm Judge Douglas Ginsburg of the United States.
I look forward, and I know Judge Kennedy is looking forward, to prompt hearings.
I would like to sit down with Gene Upshaw for one purpose only, and that would be to resolve the strike.
There are other people that have alleged things about Jim Baker.
99% of what they have printed or said bears no truth whatsoever.
Our entire complement of Pershing 2 and ground launch cruise missiles, with some 400 deployed warheads, will all be destroyed.
The mayor was pronounced dead at 1:36 this afternoon.
We lost Harold, but we cannot lose the faith.
It was a year that saw a thaw in superpower relations, one that gave us reason to hope that the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union would at long last begin to shrink. 1987 was the year Pope John Paul II visited the United States. It was also the year investors on Wall Street learned the truth behind the old adage, what goes up must surely come down. There were major changes in the Supreme Court, and President Reagan found himself embarrassed not only by his inability to nominate an acceptable associate justice, but also, and to a much greater extent, by the Iran-Contra scandal. The scandal was symptomatic of the problems 1987 brought us in the Middle East. There were other scandals, too. The Democratic frontrunner, Gary Hart, found himself embroiled in controversy over his alleged womanizing, a controversy that ended ultimately in his decision to drop out of the race for the highest office in the land. But by year's end, Hart was back in the race, throwing confusion into the Democrats' efforts to end 8 years of Republican control in the White House. Another scandal that kept us glued to our radios, televisions, and newspapers involved the Reverend Jim Baker and his PTL club. As was the case with Gary Hart, this scandal also involved a woman other than Baker's wife, Tammy Faye. 1987 was the year the National Football League Players Association learned the hard way that strikes don't always work. There were riots by inmates in federal alien detention centers in Atlanta and in Oakdale, Louisiana. Chicago lost its mayor, and the world lost some of its finest entertainers. In 1987, President Reagan sent Congress the first ever $1 trillion budget proposal. It was also the year the Democrats regained control of the Senate, and Americans were allowed to drive 65 in many states. The Giants won the Super Bowl, the Lakers were kings of the NBA, and the Minnesota Twins reigned supreme in baseball. These are just some of the happenings of the year, and when we return, we'll go deeper into these stories and more as we review the events of 1987 on the UPI Radio Network. In early December, the Hammer and Sickle flew alongside the Stars and Stripes in the nation's capital as Soviet leader Gorbachev met with President Reagan to sign a nuclear arms reduction treaty of historic proportions. Here's UPI Radio's White House correspondent, Bill Small.
Side by side, they stood on the south lawn of the White House, the Soviet General Secretary and the American president who had called the Soviet Union an evil empire. But there was none of that rhetoric this time, though.
I've often felt that our people should have been better friends long ago.
The highlight of the summit was the signing of a treaty eliminating all U.S. and Soviet medium and shorter-range nuclear missiles worldwide, the first agreement to actually reduce nuclear arms since the dawn of the atomic age. And at the signing ceremony, General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev was looking ahead to a possible treaty cutting strategic nuclear forces by half.
The treaty whose text is on this table offers a big chance at last to get onto the road leading away from the threat of catastrophe.
Mr. Reagan's overall assessment of the summit at the end was an upbeat one.
This summit was a clear success. I believe there is reason for both hope and optimism.
His summit success was something that Mr. Reagan needed badly. Most of his year in 1987 had been overshadowed by another issue. The issue was the Iran-Contra scandal, and it dogged Mr. Reagan's steps for nearly the entire year. Correspondent Pye Chamberlain has the story.
At first, some almost innocuous transfers of weapons were made to Iran as symbols of reasonableness by the Reagan administration when it seemed that the Ayatollah was losing it. It would behoove America to be on the right side of the new guys. A sticky step at a time, America started delivering serious quantities of arms under the illusion that one more shipment would produce the release of American hostages. But the president saw the hostages more vividly than the policy, and he let it continue. He said he never knew that Oliver North and Bill Casey were using the profits to finance the Contras. And when the long investigation of the affair was over, his most partisan defender, Henry Hyde of Illinois, noted that nobody ever disproved that.
It just kills the majority to have to admit there was no smoking gun, although they're still looking under every chair and every couch and every closet they can find.
But the Democrats and three of the Republicans said the arms deliveries themselves and the lack of control of events were the president's fault. Chairman Daniel Inouye of Hawaii.
We believe that the president is responsible because the Constitution specifically requires him to, and I quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
Congress is afraid something like this will happen again, but Congress is not sure what to do about it. This is Pye Chamberlain.
Some observers will say Iran-Contra was the logical result of America's problems in the Middle East during 1987, specifically problems in the Persian Gulf. UPI Radio's Tom Rivers looks at that 1987 hotspot.
In March, the Reagan administration announced its decision to grant protection to Kuwaiti oil tankers flying the American flag in the Gulf. One-sixth of the West's oil passes through the strategic waterway. The American presence represents the largest amassed naval strength since the Vietnam War. Following the U.S. move, vessels were deployed from Belgium, Holland, France, Italy, and Britain. The potential danger looming in the region showed its face on May 17th, when an Iraqi fighter hit the USS Stark in a case of mistaken identity. 37 Americans lost their lives in the attack. The tanker war dragged on. On September 11th, an Iranian vessel was captured while laying mines. On October 19th, U.S. forces destroyed an oil platform in response to ongoing aggression by Tehran. The potential loss of American lives and the high financial costs of the operation continue, and President Reagan's position will likely remain firm.
Most Americans today know the price of freedom in this uneasy world. They know that to retreat or withdraw would only repeat the improvident mistakes of the past and hand final victory to those who seek war, who make war.
This is Tom Rivers.
For many Americans, the major worldwide events of 1987 were overshadowed by personal concerns over their own and America's economic future, concerns that were heightened by the Wall Street crash of 87. UPI Radio's business editor Barbara Porter looks back.
No one quite expected what happened to the stock market in 1987. Not even the most astute analysts could fathom the charge of the bulls that started from the opening bell on the opening day of the new year. On January 5th, the bulls shattered all old records, with the Dow climbing to a high of 1971. It was a hint of what was to come. In a giddy, untethered climb, the Dow reached heights only mentioned in joking, breaking 2,700 finally. The astounding strength of the bull market kept optimism flowing about the economy, but there were signs the market couldn't sustain its highs. None that the foundation would crumble completely, though. And that made October 19th, 1987, that much more shocking. It was called Black Monday. Many words were used to describe the day the Dow lost 508 points, like meltdown, collapse. The markets went on shortened hours to help play catch-up with the frenzy of paperwork that had backed up. An investigation was launched by the White House and the SEC into computer-driven trading. The markets did finally settle down, but a year's worth of rallies had all but been forgotten in one dizzying descent. I'm Barbara Porter.
A papal repeat performance. That story and others as 1987, the year in review, continues on the UPI Radio Network. The most traveled pontiff in the history of the Catholic Church paid his second visit to the United States in 1987, a more than week-long trip that spanned the continent and evoked a variety of emotions, as UPI Radio's Rob Navius explains.
September 10th, Miami International Airport. A president and a pope stand side by side at the start of the second U.S. visit by John Paul II. A 10-day tour that would take the pope to 9 cities and over 12,000 miles to complete. President Reagan welcomed the pontiff to America under a blazing sun amidst tight security.
Americans of every kind and degree or belief will wish your holiness well, responding to your moral leadership.
Weary from his trip from Rome, but eager to start his journey through the U.S., John Paul told the president, Americans represent the best of what is good in the world.
The Lord look upon you kindly and give you peace. God bless America.
The Pope's trip was punctuated by controversy, Catholic groups and members of the clergy urging the pontiff to be more flexible in his interpretation of the teachings of Jesus. But the Pope faced two groups who wanted action and not dialogue in Miami and San Francisco, the Jews and Catholic women.
But we strongly urge once again that full and formal diplomatic relations be established between the Vatican and the State of Israel.
I expect to be treated as a mature, educated, and responsible adult.
It was a remarkable 10 days, the pontiff playing tourist and apostle all at the same time. An expensive adventure for the American Catholic Church, a critical piece of public relations for the Vatican in its effort to keep the American Catholic Church and its flock from wandering too far. This is Rob Nabius.
In 1987, one television evangelist claimed that God was going to take him off of the earth, while another evangelist was taken off of the air.
They called it the PTL Club, and for millions, especially the elderly and shut-ins, it was a kind of club, something they could share in and invest in. And the reason they gave their money and their time was that they trusted Jim Baker and his long-suffering wife, Tammy. But the contribution started drying up in 1987, and the blind faith dwindled as word of sexual forays and fiscal improprieties by the Reverend Mr. Baker surfaced. With PTL headed for bankruptcy, Jim and Tammy gave the direction of their beleaguered ministry to one of the best-known fundamentalist churchmen in the nation, the Reverend Jerry Falwell. Falwell spoke frankly of Baker's straying from the straight and narrow. He said they lacked repentance, and he pulled the plug.
From this point, no further remuneration, salaries, bonuses would be paid.
The charges of misconduct against Jim Baker began to mount. Another nationally known evangelist, the Reverend John Ankerberg, went on TV with charges of same-sex relations and wife swapping.
And many of the rumors that I just believed were rumors before, I now believe are true because of the testimony that's been given to me.
Tammy remained tearful and blamed the media for her and her husband's problems.
The media is sick and needs help badly.
But the patient on the critical list may be televangelism in general.
The overall media ministry of Christ in America has not been as open and as accountable as we should be. We're getting our hands smacked now, and we deserve it.
But the PTL ministry continued to be ailing. Only Oral Roberts got better.
It's April, and I'm alive.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
I'm Dennis Daly.
For a time in 1987, two men of the cloth appeared to be the front runners for the Democratic and GOP presidential nominations, the Reverend Jesse Jackson and evangelist Pat Robertson. Jackson had surged ahead when Gary Hart backed out after news leaked of his involvement with model Donna Rice. His re-entry into the political arena drew a diverse spectrum of comment and shook up the Democratic horse race. The decision to try it again was not one which Hart made without first consulting his family.
Getting back in this race is about the toughest thing that I have ever done. And believe me, it is not done lightly.
By year's end, Robertson's lead had dwindled on the GOP side, and the men to watch became Bush and Dole.
I got a crash on the airport. Airport's closed.
Okay, airport's closed. We got a crash at the airport.
There were three major airline crashes in 1987 in the United States. One happened in Detroit in August. A Northwest Airlines jet barely got off the ground and crashed a few blocks from the end of the runway. It is believed that for some reason the plane's flaps were not in the proper position. 156 people died. There was one survivor, a 4-year-old girl who gained worldwide attention and received thousands of presents. In November, a jet flipped over in a snowstorm while attempting takeoff from Denver. In all, 26 people on that Continental flight died, including some members of a group of high school students returning home from the Future Farmers National Convention. The cause of that crash is still being investigated. Late in the year, a PSA commuter jet fell from the skies and disintegrated on impact in California. The crash was the result of foul play, not a problem with the plane. 43 people died in that incident. Tragedy of another kind hit California in October. UPI Radio's Bob Brill has the story of the earthquake of 1987.
Homes collapsed, cars bounced on the freeway in morning rush hour traffic, and tall buildings swayed. It was an earthquake, measuring 6+ on the Richter scale. It caused tens of millions of dollars in damage and left more than a half dozen people dead. The quake was centered in Whittier, 10 miles from downtown Los Angeles, but it was felt over a wide area. It was strong and brought back memories for those who made it through the 1971 quake. Rosaria Beasley echoed the thoughts of millions.
It was shaking real fast, and some of the things on the table fell over. The glass upstairs on the second floor of the restaurant, you could hear it shaking. It was nerve-wracking.
In surveying the damage, you saw the force of Mother Nature. Cars literally crushed by falling buildings. Storefronts left only with frames as the window glass ended up on the ground in pieces. Phone service and electricity in some areas non-existent. That coupled with the constant fear of aftershocks, and you have a frightening situation. Some people left. Others stayed as they learned to come to grips with California's biggest fault. I'm Bob Brill.
The low points and high points from the world of sports when 1987, the year in review, continues on the UPI Radio Network. ...1987 will not be remembered as a good year for organized labor. The National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians went on strike against NBC, and when they returned, several hundred found themselves without jobs. But the fact that it was a less than illustrious year for labor was best demonstrated, perhaps, by the National Football League Players Association, as Bob Berger explains.
Players in the National Football League on strike.
And so for the second time in 5 years, NFL players performed on a picket line. The main issue was free agency. The union demanded it. However, Jack Donlin and the management council weren't about to give it to them.
The proposal eliminates, for all intents and purposes, our compensation system. It just takes it all out of the competitive, the balance aspect.
There was a far different aspect to this strike than the last. The owners kept the season going with replacement players, and as the weeks went by, solidarity was sacrificed for weekly paychecks, and the union caved in.
It's unfair to the players to continue making great sacrifices that they have made.
Union Executive Director Gene Upshaw sent the players back to work, then filed a lawsuit against the NFL. On opening day of the baseball season, the long career of Dodgers executive Al Campanis came to a shocking halt when on ABC's Nightline he said blacks may not have some of the necessities to be a manager or general manager. The comments set off a furor and cost Campanis his job and caused Peter Eberroth in baseball a great deal of embarrassment.
The individual does not speak for baseball. He spoke for himself. He doesn't speak for the Dodgers, as I think the Dodgers proved very clearly.
Baseball began an affirmative action program, but still there are no black managers or GMs.
Harold Washington had worked for minority rights and had risen to become mayor of one of the nation's largest cities. UPI Radio's Jenny Casola reports on Chicago, a city thrust into mourning by Washington's unexpected death.
That was a time not long ago. If you said you were Chicago, someone would make the crack. Al Capone, rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat. But now, anywhere in the world you go to any of those places and you say you're from Chicago, you know what they'll say to you? How's Harold?
On November 25th, the 65-year-old mayor was speaking with his press secretary, Alton Miller, when he suffered a massive heart attack.
He slumped to one side. I thought he was trying to pick something up off the floor, like a pen that he might have dropped. And I quickly realized that it was more serious than that.
Harold Washington's funeral was held at a large church on the city's south side. He was remembered by his friend, the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
You fought the good fight, Harold. You ran a good race. The strongest last leg we've ever seen.
The day after the funeral, Chicago City Council held a boisterous all-night session and elected Eugene Sawyer, the city's senior black alderman, as acting mayor. I'm Ginny Cosola.
In 1987, we lost some of the best-loved entertainers in the nation. The list of those who died reads like a who's who from Hollywood. Among those who left us, Danny Kaye, the incomparable Liberace, director John Huston, comedian Dan Rowan, actress Geraldine Page, drummer Buddy Rich, actor Lauren Green, and who could ever forget the great one, Jackie Gleason.
Go ahead, say it, Alan, say it. Go ahead, tell me I'm
a maniac. Go ahead. Say anything you want. But I don't care. I don't care. That's the way I feel.
Oh, Ralph. I love you.
We also lost one of the best-loved men in Hollywood, whose greatest work, without a doubt, took place in a motion picture shot in the late 1930s.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. In my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Actor, dance man Ray Bolger. Actress Rita Hayworth, a Hollywood legend and long-suffering victim of Alzheimer's disease, also died this past year. Television producer and controversial talk show host David Susskind, prolific TV producer Quinn Martin, his name became a household word. Actor Hugh Branum died during the year, known to millions as Mr. Green Jeans. Jazz great Woody Herman, whose friends came to his financial aid during his final days. Pop artist Andy Warhol, Western star Randolph Scott. The real Renaissance woman of the century died in 87, Claire Booth Luce. She showed American women they could achieve anything. And Robert Preston died. He was the music man to an entire generation. We knew him as the man who warned about trouble right here in River City. And Bob Fosse, a legend, one of the most prolific choreographers and directors in American theater history, died during the year. And we lost perhaps one of the greatest ever to take the dance floor. Fred Astaire, a suave, modest master of his art, a man who made complicated dancing and mood-making seem oh so easy.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea.
1987, The Year in Review, was produced by Dennis Daly, executive producer Michael Friedman, contributing correspondents Bill Small from the White House, Rob Navius in Miami. In Washington, Barbara Porter, Pi Chamberlain, Bonnie Urbay, Bob Berger, and Dennis Daly. In London, Tom Rivers. In Los Angeles, Bob Brill and Bob Fuss. Technical assistance from Ken Robbins. 1987, The Year in Review. I'm Ken Herrera on the UPI Radio Network.
No, they can't take that away from me.